global is an artificial construct. Global does not exist. It is a place where we interact with clients, where we win business, where we develop relationships, is in local markets. But the global piece provides consistency and provides a strategy and provides visions to be relevant locally.
If professional services marketing sometimes feels like throwing spaghetti at the wall to see what sticks, this podcast is for you. Welcome to Educated Spaghetti, marketing ideas that stick, presented by Right Hat. On each episode, your host, brand strategist Lisanne Schwartz, sits down with marketing pros and creative thinkers to untangle the marketing chaos. So pull up a chair at the Educated Spaghetti table and let's dig in.
Today, we're talking about how to reach a global audience, which is an important topic whether your offices are in one country or 21 countries. My guest is Alessandra Almeida-Jones, Global Chief Marketing Officer at the law firm BCLP, which has more than 1,200 lawyers across North America, the UK, mainland Europe, the Middle East, and Asia. Ali has also led marketing communications and campaigns for other international organizations, including the law firms Baker McKenzie, Linklaters, and King & Wood Mallesons. She has directed marketing and public relations across the EMEA region for architecture, design, and planning firm Gensler, and across the UK offices of banking and finance firm ABN AMRO. Ali draws on an extensive network of contacts across the US, UK, Europe, the Middle East, and Asia to bring her valuable combination of global perspective and local knowledge. Ali, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
You know, when we talk, I'm never quite sure where I'm going to find you. What do you like about working globally?
I do love traveling, and it never wears off, the novelty to be able to be in different places. But actually, a lot of the work is not the travel. I think what I really love about working globally is the diversity of perspective that you get by having people with different cultural, ethnic backgrounds, language skills. And I think that for me is really exciting.
How is working with a global team and marketing to a global audience different than marketing locally?
I think when you are marketing locally, you are generally defined by a geography, by a cultural context, by a set of expectations. So it's in a way easier to be targeted and easier to be relevant. The challenge of working globally is that you need to find what is common to all these different geographies that doesn't detract from their local marketing. Because by the way, global is an artificial construct. Global does not exist, right, as a place. And where we interact with clients, where we win business, where we develop relationships is in local markets. But the global piece provides consistency and provides a strategy and provides vision. So the challenge here is to make sure that everybody can recognize themselves in that global piece and that the global piece doesn't detract from one's ability to be relevant locally.
What are some good approaches that you've found successful in putting together that sort of that piece where everybody can see themselves?
I think it's really important to use your team, right? You talked about it, teams globally. You as a leader or as an individual within a firm, you can't be everywhere all the time. So you really need to rely on your colleagues' insights and views and opinions to get that level of relevance. So I think your internal network is super important because they give you eyes and ears into the organization and even into things that you might disagree. But if they are material concern or if they are important to someone somewhere, is important that you are at least aware and somehow taking that into consideration. So I think an internal network is pretty critical. And when I mean an internal network is of colleagues and partners and other business services professionals, but also I think it is going back to my earlier point, it is making sure that people can recognize themselves somehow in the initiatives you are building and rolling out. But the other thing is really having an understanding and an appreciation of what is it that we engage with as human beings. I started my career in communications and I was very external comms focused before internal comms became part of my portfolio and eventually marketing and business development. And then I sort of went full circle in really embracing the importance of internal comms and engagement, because that's in which your internal audience doesn't understand and can't articulate is very unlikely to be a proposition that you can land in the marketplace with your colleagues. So in that challenge of working locally and globally, you need to make sure that you can translate that to different cultures, but that people actually understand and can embrace that and can see themselves in it.
What does that look like in practice when you're actually taking that idea of something people can see and embrace and then trying to uncover it for yourself and then translate it into something that can work both internally and externally?
So I'm going to use Lizanne, my most recent example, which is BCLP. BCLP, Brian Cave, Litton Paisner, is a merger between Brian Cave, an excellent and very well-regarded US firm, and BLP, primarily a UK firm with international offices. And when I came to the firm couple of years ago, the firm was in a few years after the merger, but in the early stages of trying to define what is it that brought the firm together, how to go to market. And even for the partners who didn't articulate, we want to know what our brand is. People very much say, we need a consistent way to talk about the firm, to name the firm, to go to market. Even for the partners who said, I don't believe in brand and my clients don't care about brand, right? They were articulating brand to me in a different way. And at the time, the firm had made an earlier attempt at bringing that brand messaging together. And the work was really good. It was really good quality work. The reason why I think it wasn't initially successful, that earlier work, is that people couldn't necessarily see themselves in that brand and marketing proposition. So part of the work I did there is coming to the leadership team and saying, as we embark on this brand process, I promise you three things. I promise it's going to be better than what we have. It wasn't difficult because, it was really just an initial shop window. I said, I promise it's going to be reflective of our strengths in the market, in the minds of our people, and in the minds of our clients. And I promise you that even if we are not able to agree, everybody agree on the entire brand proposition, people will at least recognize themselves in it. And I very much use this analogy of looking at somebody else's wedding album that you attended as a guest, and all you do is like, oh, I'm not on that photo. I'm not on that photo, right? I'm not on that photo. And they're like, half of your forehead is on one photo and that's what you zoomed in, right? So I promise at least half of our forehead on that brand proposition for everybody. And I was supported by an amazing team, but we really started, we conducted a number of different workshops. So we workshopped about 120 people across the organization, trying to find that Venn diagram that brought the firm together, and actually going into a really lovely journey of discovering that there are more that unite firms when they merge, and that's probably why they merge, than there are things that set them apart. And being really touched by how everybody talked about the brand with great care, with great passion, with great commitment to their clients. But also as part of that process, we were testing a little bit the language and the direction of the brand. And what we were doing is every time somebody had an allergic reaction to something, we took it away and we didn't test it again. So it was probably quite an inconsistent testing process in a way, because, every workshop was slightly different, because every time somebody really objected to something, we said, we don't want that. We also spoke to a lot of clients. We spoke to about, we're using sites from about 50 client interviews, and really try to build something that people could see themselves in it. I think We had the trust of the leadership team to rather than go and choose the brand proposition themselves. We came back with three different options, and we asked the firm to trust us to take those three value propositions to market and test them with clients. And also making sure that when you're testing it with clients, you're having the voice of clients globally. So I think the global piece, we're talking very much internally, right, from an internal engagement perspective, but I think it is important externally. You know, we did work together at Baker McKenzie when we're talking about the, you know, in terms of global litigation, the global litigation force, and you did exactly that. You said, okay, we need to test this. We need to gather insights and test this with an audience that is representative of the type of business and the type of go-to-market strategy you want to build. So I think that ability to build something that people can recognize themselves in it, but also that will resonate with the different types of clients you want into market to.
Did you find that working with people in different countries, that they would view the whole idea of brand similarly? Or are there cultural differences in what you think of when you think of the idea of branding?
Actually, I think a lot of people don't name branding, right? So I remember having conversations with some lawyers who say, my clients don't care about brand. My clients don't care about brand. They appoint me. And then as you dig into it, you find out actually that lawyer cares immensely about how we talk about the firm. And that client recognizes that different law firms demand different types of fee arrangements because of their brand, right? And so you start to go, okay, you're not calling this brand, but this is brand and this is identity. So I found that the way people define brand is quite similar. Sometimes they don't recognize they are defining brand, but they are defining brand. I think the idea of brand itself is quite similar. I think how you go to market with brands locally is where it differs. And again, it's really important to enter the process knowing that you don't know, you don't live in that market, so you can't know. You need your team to be your eyes and ears into the market. You need your partners to be the eyes and ears in what works for their clients and their market. I think very often as marketers, we can be a little bit dismissive sometimes of partner view because we think we hold best practice, and we do, but we don't hold local market knowledge when we sit in global roles. So it's very important to listen. I give you an example of working, you know, starting to work in the Middle East and initially in a PR role and finding really strange that people wanted to do advertorials in kind of magazines, and then realizing that that was incredibly important for that region because people do business in hotel lobbies and they look at coffee table style magazines, right? But you can look at this and you can be dismissive if you don't understand local context. Or we have a newsletter in Atlanta that goes to our clients and our business communities about BCLP is incredibly successful in that market. It would not be successful in London. So you need to be open and challenged by other people's ideas and perceptions always.
What are some other challenges that you've found in trying to get a global message out to local business communities?
I think one of the main challenges of that global marketing piece is that we want everybody to agree on everything. And we waste an enormous amount of energy and resource trying to build unified consensus. Over the years, I've learned that you need to be much more intentional in the type of consensus you build. You need to really frame the Venn diagram that you want people to agree on. And you need to help them get the disagree and commit moment, right? So we may not agree with everything, but we are good with that Venn diagram and we are committed in terms of taking this to market.
So is that what happens when you can see that little slice of your face in the picture?
That's exactly what I think it happens, right? I also think data is really important because on one hand, you want people to be able to recognize themselves. But on the other hand, you also want the voice of the client and the voice of the market. So when you come to the table and the data will really encourage people to focus on the right things. So that process of saying our clients don't actually care about this, you know, our clients, if you go back to, you know, much earlier type of brand work, when we were all trying to say that we're technically excellent, and eventually we stopped trying to say that because it is, of course, you're technically excellent. No client would appoint you if you're not technically excellent. But it took quite a lot of work of, you know, firms doing research, you know, our consultants coming to us and say, your client does not care about that as a differentiator or as a strength that you're going to market. So the data and the insight, I think, is really important too.
How did you end up coming to Client Intelligent with PCLP?
There were three things when we did all the workshops we described and we talked to clients that people seemed to gravitate towards. One was that we have great enduring relationships with clients. And I was a bit skeptical because a lot of firms say we are a relationship firm. And of course, we are a relationship business, right? We don't go to a dentist we detest or an accountant we despise. We work with people because we like working with people. But when we looked at the qualitative data, both internally and externally, that seemed to be really true. A lot of clients were telling us that they really enjoyed the experience of working with PCLP. One of our clients told us, I love working with you guys because you collaborate without ego. I don't sit there waiting for you to try and coordinate with another team who may or may not be wanting to put some hours to my matter. But also when we looked at data, that also seemed to be true. We realized that 50% of the firm's clients have been clients of the firm for at least 10 years. And then 40% of the firm's clients had been clients of the firm for at least 20 years. So really, this idea that we build enduring relationships turned out to be true. The second element was that we delivered real value. And by real value was this idea that, and this is not about price point, but it's this idea that the entire experience was something that the clients valued. We brought to the table technical knowledge, but we also worked in a way that was smart and was fast. And probably because we got to understand the clients over time, right? So we built this idea that we could do that. And the third thing was obviously technical expertise and commerciality. So when we were looking at these three things, we came up with three different value propositions. And but rather than spend an awful lot of time trying to choose between them, we really asked for permission and endorsement from the board to take them to market. And we interviewed, surveyed rather, about 200 legal buyers across a number of different jurisdictions and asked them what resonated to them in terms of, you know, what was the best way to choose a legal provider, what kind of message would sway them, what felt more premium, what felt more accessible. And we even tested things like the logo and taglines. So by the time we presented the work back to the firm, there was so much data behind it that that wedding album analogy really turned out to be true. And the approval process, because the process itself was so front-loaded, the approval process was really easy.
Did you find that people responded differently to the ideas depending on what jurisdiction they were in?
Yes, absolutely. It was really fascinating to see that when we surveyed clients in Asia, for example, the idea of the relationship element was really important. It was important everywhere, but it was really important, more important so in Asia than they were in other parts of the world. There were other parts of the world that commerciality, so in the US, commerciality was really important. So there were definitely nuances, right? I think relationship was important everywhere, but more important so in Asia. But there were nuances, definitely, in terms of what people preferred and gravitated towards.
Does trying to reach different audiences cause you to use things like social media and other tools in different ways?
I think we should all be using it in slightly different ways, right? I think I personally believe that this idea of produce once and publish the same everywhere, I think the more I look at it, the more I disagree with it. I think you have global channels, so you need to be very mindful that, you know, there is nothing you do on your Germany social media channel is for Germany only, right? Because we live in a very globalized world. But I think you do need to understand which channels resonate better with which geographies. So for example, in Asia, and I believe it is still true, but a lot of people just did, you know, deal communication on WhatsApp, a lot of communication between clients and attorneys on WhatsApp, right? WeChat, other channels that are much, much more relevant. And so you need to be quite sensitive to what works best where.
What do you think is the biggest mistake people make about marketing globally?
So I think the biggest mistake people make in marketing globally is forgetting that global doesn't exist. Global is an artificial construct. We win business, we build relationships, we attract and retain talent locally. Global is here to bring unity, to bring consistency, and to bring impact, right? Because if you say the same thing in lots of different places, you build recall, you build an identity, you bring a brand more easily. So in doing that, it's easy to forget that you don't have to get everybody to agree on everything in order to build a global brand. You need to be intentional and get people to agree on some things. And that is your global brand, is what resonates across your platform with most people. And you need to be flexible enough to understand that there will be nuances in how you take this to market. And it is a mistake to try and dictate that globally, because you can't possibly have that market knowledge. And there is another pitfall in doing that. If you try to dictate it globally, you take people's power of action away. And if you take people's power of action away, they can't own your brand. They only own your brand if they feel they can pick it up, they can touch it, they can, you know, they are engaged with it. If they feel that they're just pushing it out, they develop no ownership, no pride, no engagement with the brand.
How do you help your local teams build the ability to take a global brand and then extend it or empower others in different locations to take it out to their markets in a way that will resonate locally?
I think structurally, you build your brand and you drive, you kind of articulate areas of flex or areas of exception, right? So this is, I think, what you do in terms of the brand architecture. You go, this is how we talk about the brand universally. This is our universal message. Just this, you know. But it is very difficult to dictate upfront how this is going to be customized locally. So you have to, in a way, it's a little bit like a riding a horse that you need to kind of keep the direction. You need to keep the reins, but you need to be flexible enough to let it meander a bit, to see where this is going to go. And I know this is an answer that a lot of marketers aren't going to like, but the reality, the practicality of it is that there are lots of things that when you first launch your brand, you don't know that will become very important locally. So you need to make some judgment calls and you need to make them intentionally and you need to make them consistently, but you need to make some judgment calls along the way. So for example, for us, we are originally a St. Louis firm, and in St. Louis, the firm is still largely known as Brian Cave, and we need to, you know, to enable the market to make that transition. We never want to lose that connection with Brian Cave in the St. Louis market. So we go to market in St. Louis in a slightly different way, you know, and over time, I'm sure this will evolve, but you need to help markets preserve what is important to them and not, otherwise you end up detracting from the power of the brand.
It sounds like you really need to practice some flexibility, even when there's a brand that you've poured your heart and soul into creating for everyone. You still need to be able to let other people sort of take it from there.
And it's kind of balancing two very, very different things in each hand. One is the need for consistency, and what you establish that needs to be consistent. You need to absolutely be very intentional and defend it fiercely, but also you need to have the common sense to understand when and where this needs to be flexible. So be fierce about the consistency and be smart about the flex and the exceptions.
Are there any resources that you recommend for someone who's really looking to better understand the idea of, if not global, global plus local marketing?
There is a book I love and is called The Cultural Map by Erin Meyer. And she is an American psychologist that works with people really coaching executives on how to work globally. As you can pick up from the accent, I'm not a native English speaker. I'm originally from Brazil. And when I first read that book, it blew my mind. I finally understood why I probably spent my first, 5 years in the UK feeling mildly offended by this and that and the other, right? She really explains very well the nuances of working globally and how that is reflected in people's communication style. So I would recommend that to anyone.
The Cultural Map.
The Cultural Map.
I can't wait to take a look at it. What's your secret sauce for successful marketing in a global context?
I think the secret sauce to working globally is actually not technical expertise. Technical expertise is important. But I think the secret sauce is real, is empathy, is curiosity, and it is the ability to build relationships. That comes with a huge degree of humility. You have to understand you just don't know. You have to trust in your team and you have to listen to your partners, even if sometimes what people are telling you doesn't feel right or doesn't feel implementable. You need to recognize that if it's important to them, you need to pay attention. My final tip is, if you work globally, going back on the relationship thing, make sure you regularly catch up, not with somebody in the local markets, with people in the local markets, be that within the wider team or catch up with a partner. Don't just rely on your immediate direct reports. Really build your internal network.
So for listeners, if you would like to connect with Ali, you can find her on LinkedIn, or possibly traveling the world. Ali, thank you so much for joining me to share your ideas, your experiences, what inspires you. It's really been wonderful having you here.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
That's our serving of Educated Spaghetti for today. Thank you to Maddie Langle for producing this episode and managing our social media. Thank you to Charlene Fabi for our logo design and music. And thanks to you for listening. To comment on today's topic or suggest future episodes, please visit us at righthat.com. And if you enjoyed this episode, please like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We'll see you next time for more marketing ideas that stick.